There's so much that we don't know about serial killers, the ones we found and the ones that we haven't found, yet we stake so much in our ability to understand and apprehend them, when I would argue that we know very little.
Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasting.
Every raindrop reflecting on the water as the sun shuts her eyes. Don't know what you'll uncover. Watch the tide rolling with the moonlight. Everything is silent on this Louisiana night.
This is Missing Magnolias, and today we are covering the murders of the Gilgo Beach Killer, also known as the Long Island Serial Killer Lisk. And highlights have been made to this case in the way of forensic genealogy. He was apprehended this summer. So we're just going to dive right in.
Yeah, okay. Well, here's the thing. We don't really know a lot about Lisk, if we're going to be honest, right? We had these homicides that were, these bodies that were identified on Gilgo Beach, really high profile case where we were searching for a missing person in a really wealthy and isolated community in Long Island. And then we have a police officer going to bring his dog to help in the search. He pulls over on the side of the road so the dog can use the bathroom, and the dog hits, which was completely unexpected for anybody. And so we start digging, and this is a collective we, I was not involved, and they find first one body, then four bodies, and then they start to realize that they have a whole lot of human remains along this beach. And this was in 2010. And so there's lots of controversy surrounding the case. There's lots of theories. I think last year, or maybe even this year, we got a really great book called Lost Girls, which is definitely worth a read about the case. But it was before Lisk was arrested. But then this summer, I believe, we had an arrest of the suspect that we think is the Long Island serial killer. And his name is Rex Huerman. And there's been lots of talks about Rex in a whole lot of ways. Talks about how this offender apprehended his victims, how this offender evaded detection for so long, how this offender does not fit what we know about serial killers. And then there's a whole bigger conversation, I think, to be had about how we handle this in the media, right? We know that his wife has been offered a $1 million deal from Peacock. I don't know if any of the victims' families have been offered $1 million deals from Peacock. And also we know that they are trying to push some laws surrounding that, trying to make it so that families of offenders cannot profit from anything related to the case, that the only people who should be able to profit from a case like this are the victims.
What a crazy way to begin an investigation with this disappearance of this one woman, Shannon Gilbert.
We eventually found Shannon.
Right.
But we don't even know how Shannon died, honestly. So there were no obvious signs of homicide. However, her hyoid bone, mm-hmm. if I'm saying that correctly, in her neck was missing. Mm-hmm. So we don't know if that was broken during strangulation or not. That would be the primary way that we would tell that she was strangled. And so not having that bone, and I think that's the only bone missing, is really, really troublesome for the case. So if I recall correctly, her case is still undetermined, suspicious circumstances, surely, but we don't know if she was killed, period, or if she was killed by Lisk. We know that she was in a whole lot of trauma and panic at the time that she went missing. So she was a sex worker. She was on a job in this wealthy community. And she, from what we understand, sort of had like a mental breakdown and a freak out. She called the cops. She was asking for help. She called 911. She said people were after her.
And that call was like 23 minutes long, and it took police like an hour to get there.
And the call has not been fully released to the public. And there's been a lot of concerns about what maybe on that call that we don't know about. So yeah, she was by all accounts running around screaming in pure panic and chaos. But when her driver came to pick her up, she refused to get in the vehicle with him. She ran to other people's homes asking for help. And when they said, oh my gosh, I'm going to call the police, she freaked out and ran away. So we know that she was in an unstable mindset. There's been some talk about whether or not she had been on drugs, whether or not she had mental health problems that were untreated, that maybe she took some bad drugs and had some sort of psychotic break. Maybe she was just having some extreme mental health issues. Maybe somebody was after her. We don't know. So that's one part of the question that we need to figure out. Another part of it is there were several human remains found along Gilgo Beach, Fire Island, Massapequa in general. And Rex Huerman has only been charged with the main four. Mm-hmm. Which is Maureen.
Yes, the Gilgo Four is Melissa Bartholomew, Maureen Brainard, Megan Waterman, and Amber Costello, who were originally, when they were found, were like 500 feet apart in the burlap sacks.
Melissa, Maureen, Amber.
Megan.
Melissa, Maureen, Amber, and Megan. Melissa, Maureen, Amber, and Megan are the original four, the Gilgo Four that we're calling them. The cases that were most prominently featured in the book Lost Girls and in the Netflix adaptation of the first part of that book, which is also a really, really good watch and gives some insight into the families. So we have our original four plus Shannon are featured in Lost Girls. And he's been tied to those original four, not Shannon, and then tied with DNA to three of them. The sum of the DNA is hair of his wife. So that goes back to the big discussion in the media as to whether or not the wife is involved. I think the answer to that is no, but that's a larger conversation to have later. So we've got some good links to him for these original four found in the burlap sacks. The burlap sacks were a really big piece of evidence that we've had since 2010 that everybody has been talking about. How could the burlap sacks, everybody said it has to be part of his job. You know, it has to be somebody who has contact with this. And then the other big clue that we had for since 2010 was the belt with the HW or HM. We didn't know which way it was. And now we can obviously link that to Rex Huerman and his family name and all that comes with that. So there is a good amount of evidence. And I think it's important that we note that Huerman was apprehended thanks to forensic genetic genealogy. Really, this story is about the advancement of technology. Without forensic genetic genealogy, we probably would not have been able to find this offender, at least not as soon as we did. And I mean, I say soon in air quotes because it took us a long time. But this technology didn't exist in 2010. We didn't know how to apply it appropriately in 2010, so it wasn't on anyone's radar. And then if you read Lost Girls, our author takes a really deep dive in to try and identify who the potential offenders could be. He goes through their family and their partners and everybody living in that community and all of the possible suspects. And Rex Huerman was not on anybody's list. And what we know from law enforcement, of course, we don't know everything, right? We're never going to know everything until that case is closed for good reason. But it doesn't seem that he was on anybody's list.
Yeah, and it's such a big part, his arrest too. You know, it all started with a pizza crust, and he made so many mistakes with the burner phones is a whole other kind of can of worms to open.
I don't know. It doesn't seem that he made that many mistakes. I mean, okay, let's have the bigger conversation, I think, about the victims. So we're talking about a serial killer who, okay, probably killed these four. Like, if you have DNA evidence, I believe it, right? So, like, let's just say he killed these four. There are also lots of other remains found along Gilgo Beach, right?
Right.
We have Peaches and Peaches' daughter, who have yet to be identified. We have Asian Doe, who has yet to be identified, and these victims have yet to be charged. Rex Huerman has yet to be charged for these victims' homicides. And then we also have some scattered remains in the mix of victims who have been, at least one victim who has been identified, whose partial remains were found with some of the original ones along Gilgo Beach. And then there's the Fire Island victims a little further down the road who some of them are the scattered remains and some of them are not.
And these, I think I remember reading, they were found in maybe garbage bags, so different in that they weren't found in the burlap bags.
They were not found in the burlap sacks.
But can you talk more about just how unique is this kind of scattering?
The scattering is a larger question. It appears that our offender was testing the waters of potential dump sites. Now, I could be wrong. I could be completely wrong. I only have pieces of the information. I am not, you know, the leading expert on serial killers and how they dump bodies. So I couldn't be missing pieces of the puzzle. However, it appears that this offender took some time, a really long time ago, to figure out what possible dumping grounds would be the best. Because we have one victim's remains who was scattered at Gilgo Beach, at Fire Island, and along roadways in Massapequa. So what I think Lisk was doing was taking that early victim and putting them in different places and waiting. Just sitting back and waiting to see what would happen. And then when he noticed that individual's remains remains were found along the roadways in Massapequa, he thought, oops, not going to go back there. Then when those victims' remains were found at Fire Island, he thought, oops, not going to go back there. And then when those remains were never found at Gilgo Beach, he thought, oh, this is where I'm going. This is the sweet spot. Like Goldilocks, like a terrible Goldilocks serial killer. And it makes me wonder, A, how often had he done this before? And how perhaps unreliable or offenders may be when it comes to how they handle body dumping. You know, we think that they behave in very set ways. This type of killer dumps or doesn't dump. This type of killer poses or doesn't pose victims' remains or whatever. But what if what was actually happening was just stages in their development? Right? Like if we had caught Lisk when he was scattering, we would have never thought he was somebody who would do the burlap sack dumping of the bodies, right? Because it hadn't happened yet. So perhaps what we used to do with serial killers were look at the bad ones who got caught maybe earlier in their trajectories, like bad at criming, right? Bad at serial killing, like not as efficient or able to avoid detection. You know, what I worry about is what if all of that, all those decades of research were to an extent wrong?
Wow.
Because we weren't catching these offenders who were really good at criming. Obviously, this offender is responsible for more victims, like obviously. And I think we don't even begin to know the number of victims that he's responsible for because we know he had homes in other states. And we know that the average solo male serial killer starts offending in their mid to late 20s. And we caught Rex at 51?
Yeah, 59.
59? Come on. He didn't, in 2000, let's take 20 years off of it, still. That's 10 years in his trajectory, 10 years later. So I would bet money that I don't have, that he has lots more victims than we're aware of. So then it begs the larger question, what if forensic genetic genealogy is going to allow us to catch the better serial killers? Mm-hmm. And how is that going to inform how we teach people to investigate serial homicide? I mean, I teach students who are going into law enforcement, they're gonna be practitioners at all levels and all avenues of law enforcement and criminal justice. So I need to prepare them for the real world, right? And I'm trying to do the best that I can with that. So that means relying on evidence-based research and all of what we have since John Douglas, right? And the original three and everything we have from that. But then we didn't have technology that we have today, right? When those profiles were created, we didn't even have DNA in the way that we do now. Now, don't get me wrong. They've been refined. They've been tested. We've made tons and tons of advancements. But again, that's based on old offenders, right? How different are our new serial killers? And I put that in air quotes because I think that they're like the East Area Rapists and the Grim Sleepers. Like Rex is another one of them. They're OGs that have been operating for a long time. They've been very good at it and they've gone undetected. That's where we need to be focusing our research nowadays, is looking at the ones who have been able to evade detection for decades. What have they been doing? And I guarantee you we know that they changed their MO. Like we learned that very quickly in the game, that you cannot link a serial killer based on their MO. Because their MO is guaranteed to change because they refine over time. They find things that they like and don't like. They progress in their relational paraphilic attachments and their need to be more violent, or they just want to avoid detection. So they shoot some people and strangle some people and stab other people and all of those kinds of things, right? That we know they change their MO. Now, what people have always said is that their signature remains the same. So that signature is the thing that's personal to them, meaningful to them, that the average person would not understand or know of, and that is what is likely to remain stable. And we thought the burlap sacks were his signature.
Because he's a hunter.
Those burlap sacks were meaningful in some way to him, but then he didn't even use them on all of his victims. Mm-hmm. You know, some people say scattering remains means that you treat them like trash or you hate them, but he didn't scatter all of them. So did he not treat some of them like, you know what I mean? Like right. It just doesn't work. Our old typologies don't work in the same way for this offender. Now, part of it could be because we just don't know all of his offending trajectory, but we've never known any of our serial killers' full offending trajectories. We don't know how many people the Green River Killer actually killed. We know he killed a lot more than he was convicted for because he said that openly, but we have no idea how many victims he actually, we haven't even identified all of his victims. They identified one yesterday. So there's so much that we don't know about serial killers, the ones we found and the ones that we haven't found, yet we stake so much in our ability to understand and apprehend them, when I would argue that we know very little.
I mean, just on the people that they have found, from I think the first person was 1996, and we know very little about her, but I mean, what would you be looking for in that early?
Well, he wasn't using Craigslist.
Karen Vergata in 1996.
There we go. Thank you for remembering her name, because I forgot.
And they're saying there's new information coming out daily now. There are reports that she was linked at possibly a swingers event at Rex and his wife, Asa Ellerup's house, shortly before she disappeared.
So that's, it could be exactly how he originally got his victims, were just people involved in sex work or deviant sexual activity. And he had easy access to them. Or maybe he got questioned early on and decided he had to find his victims with some more distance, perhaps. We know that he probably, like most serial killers, went after sex workers because he knew they were disposable. And what I mean by that is that the media and the general public would be unlikely to care that they went missing, and that the police would be unlikely to investigate. The average person knows that, right? So do our serial killers, because they're part of our society. So they know the same things as us. And so he probably went after that type of victim. So we could say that seems to remain consistent. But I would even argue that he probably, his early kills were not sex workers, I would bet. Surely there's some in there that weren't. So that's probably a piece of the puzzle. They say, some researchers say, that their earliest victims have a closer relationship to them than the later victims. But we don't know whose earliest victim was. We think it's 1996 Karen, but we're probably not sure, right? There's probably earlier than that as well. So we know eventually he turned to Craigslist, because that's how the Gilgo Four, were solicited, and the last known sighting of them was meeting a John, which was the same MO, the same scenario for Shannon, which is one of the reasons why they believe that Shannon is a Lisk victim, even though it was a different John that solicited her.
Right, and then even her attorney is coming out and saying that there's possibly a connection to Rex Huerman.
I mean, gosh, it seems like, I really usually don't believe in coincidence, but boy, would Rex have had to have been lucky. He would have had to have been out that night visiting his remains and surveying his, and probably stroking his ego. And then here comes this victim just like in his lap. I just think that's unlikely.
Right.
I think it's more likely that it's coincidence. Although I hate saying that, because that doesn't feel right.
And they said she drowned, I think, and which there's no evidence that she drowned. It was a small marsh.
It was a bogish. Maybe marsh is the right word to use, but very difficult to navigate. Swampy-like, hard to walk in. And it appears as though she was lost and walked in. Didn't realize how hard it would be to navigate that. Mm-hmm. Like the weeds were really, really high, like higher than you could see. It was not anything that you would go play around in. Kids wouldn't run around in it. It was gross, wet, muddy, and lots of bramble and things that could get you stuck. So it is possible that she got stuck in the mess of it, and that she had on some heavy clothes and maybe was trying to take off her clothes because they were all wet and gross, and that in the process of that, she caught up, fell, and drowned. That is totally possible.
You mentioned Lost Girls and the film as well, and her mother, Mary Gilbert, was such a big pioneer for all of these girls.
Oh, I love to talk about the book Lost Girls and the depiction of those victims. I loved how every chapter was a name of the girls, of the women who went missing. It was so humanized and personal, and I think that's really important when we talk about serial killers, because we spend so much time just glamorizing serial killers, the offenders. We're losing a big part of what is the realness of this, which is profound trauma. Having a person go missing long term is incredible. We've talked about this, is incredibly traumatic for everyone involved. Not having answers is the worst thing that can happen. And what we saw from the pasts of these girls, these women, they didn't have an easy road. And, you know, some of them turned to sex work because there really were no other options to feed themselves. It's a quick way to make a lot of money, but it's very dangerous. And I believe the women, they knew that, and they didn't have any other options. I mean, when you look around, even at where they were living and the financial strain in those communities, the loss of jobs. One of our victims had just recently lost her telemarketing job, and that was the only job in that community. You couldn't go to the job tree and pull jobs off, you know, like It's Always Sunny. So there just were no options for these people. And so we talk about sex work as being like this horribly, terribly deviant thing that happens, but like, it was the only option for these women to provide from their perspective for their livelihood. Some of them had children, some of them just needed to live, right? And so they were in this really precarious situation. And when we learn about their past, we learn that they usually had trouble with families, and that growing up at home, it was hard, you know, and a lot of them didn't graduate high school, or they struggled through high school. And so they didn't have, early on, they were set up to not have lots of opportunities for legitimate success. So you can kind of get that picture throughout their lives. And what we know about Mary in the book was that the author didn't hold any punches about Mary's early parenting behaviors, and it didn't look good, right? We know that Shannon had been under the care of CPS several times. She had been taken out of the home and put in the system or to live with other relatives. So we know that there were some significant problems at home. What is interesting is as soon as Shannon went missing, Mary just seemed to find all of this strength and ability and really became the spokesperson for these girls. She fought the media and the police when they told her that her daughter didn't matter because she was a sex worker. She was always in the news. She was holding vigils and marches and standing up for these girls in ways that no one else had. And we could argue that we wouldn't be talking about these cases today if it hadn't been for what Mary had done. And so in this instance of something so horrible and terrible, there was this opportunity for this woman to find a sort of redemption for a brief moment, you know, to finally be the voice for her daughter that perhaps she hadn't had the ability to do before. But what's even more tragic is that Mary's now deceased. She was murdered by her own daughter in a psychotic fit. She was stabbed to death by Shannon's younger sister. So just a whole lot of trauma and tragedy for these families overall. And I'd like to point out that even though we have an arrest and I hope eventually we have a conviction, there's no such thing as justice. There's no such thing as justice for these families, right? What justice would be making right. And you can't bring these girls back and you can't take away the terrible things that have happened. And there, a lot of our people are gone and they'll never see, you know, they'll never be able to go in that courtroom and stand and talk for their daughters, right? So this really is, I think, an opportunity to have a much larger and harder conversation in a lot of ways. And I hope that we take that generally as a society instead of just glamorizing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it seems like we spend so much time trying to, you know, how do we predict this kind of behavior? How do we profile these kind of people? And, you know, I've heard, why don't we look more at the groups that they target, that they offend, you know, like the sex workers, like gay men, the elderly?
Because that would require actual social change. That would require us having social welfare, right? I've written articles about how we should handle sex work in America. And the truth of it is a lot of the research is mixed because we have none of the social services available. So what we can't do is say, okay, sex work is decriminalized. Go for it, everyone. And then do nothing for these people who turn to sex work as their only means of survival, right? Or the people who take advantage of the people who are in these precarious situations. That will require us to have much larger conversations of how we want to handle the ills of our society and or how we want to handle mental illness, right? The people who make our laws do not put in place anything that would provide for the extreme mental health problems we have in our community. And when we talk about how to prevent this kind of thing, that will require us changing how we parent our children, right? If you read the textbook by Eric Hickey, and that is the textbook on serial offenders and their victims, one of the most prominent ones used in academia, you know, he ends that book talking about how the only hope for our future is to change the homes, right? It starts with violence in the homes. It starts with the feelings of othering of those children when they go to school and they feel like they don't fit in and they can't make friends and they'll never get the things that other people have. Why aren't our parents noticing that our kiddos are struggling in that way? And I mean, easy to say and hard to do, right? It would require a whole lot of social change that I think largely as a society, we're unwilling to make. We'd have to stop looking at ourselves and start looking at how we can help our neighbors, how we can help our community. Right? Those words freak people out. So I don't know.
And now a quick ad break.
Greetings, Missing Magnolias fans. Looking for more spine-chilling tales of true crime to thrill you?
Then step aboard the murder coaster.
I'm Krista.
And I'm Matthew.
And every week we bring you hour-plus deep dives into history's most bizarre and brutal crime stories.
So strap in.
Keep your hands and feet inside the ride.
And take a trip on
Murder Coaster.
Murder Coaster Podcast, available everywhere you listen to podcasts.
When you really get to the nuts and bolts, he's not that interesting, right?
No, he's just a white architect who looks like an ogre.
Right.
And I'm not even saying that to be mean. That is the description from the one person who saw Rex Uhrman when Lisk was unknown. They said he looked like an ogre, and they are not wrong.
Can we talk about the burner phones? Because like you mentioned, the genealogy is such a game changer. And a big thing about this case to me was the burner phones. Like,
he was using burner phones to communicate with all of the victims.
Which are allegedly untraceable.
Allegedly untraceable, yes. And he would often not use the same burner phone, so he would get lots of different ones. We did have some pings. Early pings, but again, in 2010, you know, we didn't have the technology that we had today. We didn't have as many towers. We couldn't, to be able to triangulate, you have to have at least 3 towers, right, to get a good idea of where somebody is. And we didn't have all of that technology in the way that we do today. So I think if that case happened today, we would be better at being able to identify that offender earlier in the game, but we just didn't have enough. I mean, and one could also argue that they didn't start looking at this as a crime until those victims were found, which is much later than they went missing, right? Mm-hmm. When did they go missing? 2000 and...
The Gilgo 4?
Yeah.
Oh, like 2007, 2010?
Okay, yeah. So let's say it's 3 years. They had a 3-year lag in that investigation, right? So they've lost already the most important... I mean, the most important evidence can be lost in the first 48 to 72 hours, right? So there's no CCT footage we can go back and look at the train station to see where Rex was meeting this woman, right? There's none of that. Today, we can do it a lot better. We have a lot more CCTV capabilities. We have a lot more interconnectedness of agencies. Law enforcement now knows they need to immediately go and collect that information. At least they should know that. So we didn't have, we were playing catch up by the time we started actually investigating those cases. We were years behind for some of them. So a lot of that evidence was lost. It was a hard case to investigate because you didn't have, we had some DNA, but not a lot, right? And then they did all of the testing that was available then and found nothing. We now know when we went back and look at his search history that he was searching the whole time. Not only is he like obviously a sadist who's into torture and other kinds of really terrible things, which makes me think that he's a particular type of offender. He probably tortured his victims to an extent based on the things that he was looking for in his internet searches. He was also searching for status updates. He was also searching for things like, why haven't they looked at the phone records of the Lisk killer. Like, he was questioning.
He didn't know incognito mode?
Apparently not. Thank God he didn't. But because we get a little bit of insight as to who this person is, and it also helps confirm that this is our offender, right? Because he was searching for status updates on every one of those victims.
And he, I mean, how horrible. He was calling some of the victims' families from their phone and just taunting them.
He called at least one victim and taunted them and said, I'm watching your sister rot, which is a very particular type of offender that does this. Most serial killers would never call the family. For one, they're not invested, right? These people are disposable.
Psychopaths.
They're trash. They're not invested at all. He obviously had some ego issues that he needed to be reminded of how amazing he is, right? So that reflects a little bit of narcissism, perhaps, right? People think people with narcissistic personality disorder have big egos in that they feel great about themselves, but that's incorrect. They feel fucking horrible about themselves, and so they're constantly telling themselves how great they are. Their ego is fragile, very like a broken egg. Right. And so anytime anybody says, hey, your hair is out of place. Oh, my God, my little egg is broken now. Right. And I'm going to freak the fuck out. Oh, you didn't replace the milk. Ah, my little fragile ego. Right. Like, so any instance of somebody touching that fragile ego breaks them apart and makes them lash out about how great they are. And they're constantly telling themselves how great and wonderful they are because it's so fragile. Right. There's that saying, like, as soon as you couldn't possibly have it, it's already yours. Right. As soon as you can't take this thing, this terrible thing, you're probably struggling with that terrible thing. So he, in my mind, was doing things like taunting the victims' families because he needed to continue to feel powerful. It wasn't enough. He felt weak that day. Maybe somebody insulted him at work and he had to go and make a phone. You know, like, they really are quite pathetic.
So he's a narcissist and he's a sociopath.
I don't know if he ranks high in psychopathy. He could not. I wouldn't call him a sociopath because there's a distinction between psychopath, sociopath, and antisocial personality disorder. And I'm one of those nerds that kind of care about that. Sociopath is defined. I'm going to give you my definition of it.
Cliff notes. Yeah.
Bad at criming. They commit a lot of crimes, but they get caught for a lot of crimes. So they have really extensive histories. They usually have substance abuse problems, lots of unhealthy relationships, domestic violence instances, that kind of stuff. I don't think that's Rex. Now then, psychopath and antisocial personality disorder are two fields of study. They argue about the difference or distinction between the two, but they both share a lack of empathy, high superficial charm, glibness, you know, being rule breakers, not caring about other people. They share those characteristics. I'm not going to go into more of a distinction between the two, but most serial killers do not rank high in psychopathy or antisocial personality disorder. So I don't know if he has those things, but it does sound like he's very narcissistic and could have a narcissistic personality disorder combined with perhaps a paraphilia like sexual sadism disorder, where he receives sexual gratification from the degradation, pain, and torture of others. But also that could sometimes be a byproduct of that narcissism. So I would need to know more. But I mean, he's got a lot of problems. Yeah.
I mean, and we don't even know a lot about the manner of death. They're keeping all that pretty tight-lipped. We don't even know if they were strangulated.
Well, we think that they were strangled because there weren't obvious signs of, like, there were no stab wounds on their bones. There were no gunshot wounds. So then the natural progression of that is strangulation. Also, the belt is a good sign that he did some strangling if he left the belt on one of them. And also, those types of offenders who want power and control in that way will often repetitively strangle their victims, like Samuel Little did. Strangle them until they pass out, let them regain consciousness, strangle them again, do that a bunch of times.
Okay, so is the strangulation by extension a form of kind of sexual gratification? Because we don't know that he assaulted, we don't have any...
I mean, I would say sure, probably, but he also probably did something real gross and weird, like jack off while he strangled them, or maybe raped them and strangled them at the same time, and then ejaculated as they died. Like, that's a big thing serial killers will do, because it's not just the torture, but it's also the thrill of the kill. Like, there's a combination of those two, and yes, there are some distinctions, but like, you're never going to feel more powerful than when somebody else is life is in your hands, you know what I mean?
And this man was, as you said, like an ogre. He was giant, and these women were all petite women. Like,
he was
tiny,
a big motherfucker, man. He's somebody you could stab in the neck and they wouldn't go down. Like, you know, you look at him and he's a big, sturdy. I wouldn't want to meet him on a back alley.
Did you see the interview with the woman that survived? She was a former escort, you did, and one of the weird, you know, she had all of the red, thankfully all the red flags were going up for her on their date, and she didn't end up going any further. But one of the weird things he had said was, do you like true crime, and do you know about these Gilgo Beach murders?
It's funny, that's the same thing that Ed Kemper would do, a similar thing. He would pick up victims, well, this is what he says, that he would not kill the victims who brought up the fact that there was a serial killer in the community. Like, sometimes they'd get in the car and they'd be like, oh man, it's scary taking a ride these days because there's somebody out there killing girls. And he wouldn't kidnap that victim. It's almost like when he was faced with it, he was like, oh, she's not the one. Like, maybe he only wanted to go for the ones who were he deemed as perhaps careless. I don't know. But he wouldn't kill those. So it's interesting that he didn't kill the victim that he talked to about Lisk. Interesting.
Very interesting. And we still have, you know, so many, few of these people are unidentified. And one of them, the Asian male that was found in, which doesn't fit the...
They think that the Asian Doe was a sex worker who was trans or dressed as a woman because they were in women's clothing. And it would also fit, you know, the sex worker sort of victimology. But there is also some speculation that maybe he dressed the victim. So...
Wasn't that in his search history as well? Asian... Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Asian
He's trying,
male.
Yeah, yep. Trying to figure out if they identified them. And I would bet that they're now using, now that this break has been made, that they're using forensic genetic genealogy to identify Peaches and Asian Doe. So they call her Peaches because she had a tattoo of peaches, and they were trying to use that to bring it all these tattoo parlors to see if anyone could identify it. But it was a really generic kind of tattoo. So no one's been able, I don't think anyone's been able to say where they got that tattoo. And this is the thing. It is really hard, unless an offender confesses, it's really hard to convict them for a crime when you don't know who the victim is. And so being able to identify these remains will greatly help the investigation, because then they'll be able to triangulate how he came into contact with them. But again, there are some people who say that those victims are not connected. I think it's highly unlikely that two serial killers would be using the same dump spot and not be aware of each other. So, and then be pissed off about that, I would assume. So I don't think that there would be two serial killers in the night dumping their bodies. It's likely that it was just one and that it was Rex.
What a strange run-in. Can you imagine?
That meme where they're just pointing at each other. All the Spider-Men. It's terrible.
Can we talk about the 12-day raid that happened at their home in Long Island? Because a lot has come out about that.
So they were hoarders. They were gross, weird hoarders. I'm just saying that because he's been arrested as a serial killer.
The house didn't fit. Like, the exterior didn't seem to fit the rest of the neighborhood. It looked, like, more shabby. And Long Island has parts that are very, very wealthy.
Yeah.
He's an architect.
It seemed a bit of a mess, which is also suggestive of the mess that was in his head. You know what I mean? Like, stuff that appears out in the world. And then he was a gun collector, a collector, like, of a lot of things,
like 279 right? guns, rifles that they collected.
So I wonder what the police have that are signatures, mementos, the things he kept. And they say every serial killer has a signature. There's something they put or take. They like to have souvenirs that are mementos to them to remind them of their offenses, right? Even Dexter had his little blood slides. So I'm very curious about what Rex has, or if they've even found it, because he has lots of property. And I think people assume it's going to be like jewelry or something, but like, it could be something really innocuous, or it could be something that we could never find. It could be photographs that were Polaroids that are buried, that will never, you know, like, I just wonder, or is there nothing?
Wow.
Could we be wrong about this whole souvenir thing? Could he have kept nothing?
Wow.
But he's a collector.
Right. The guns, the hunting, yeah.
Suggests he kept something.
Interesting. And then there was the soundproof room for the weapons, which is very suspicious, as well as the late night trash burning.
Yeah, yeah, that's real suspicious too, which could be, you know, their clothes, because some of them were not found clothed. Could have been burning evidence. Most people don't burn trash late at night.
Not where I'm from.
Not where I'm from either. And then I guess we should speak to the wife, mm-hmm. you know?
So her hair was found, and they've been talking about transference a lot, which apparently is common. It's not abnormal.
Yeah, and I think Rex probably felt a little bit bold because he knew that his DNA wasn't anywhere, and it probably wasn't in his brain that we would have forensic genetic genealogy. Who could have expected this, right? Thank you, all of the white people, middle-class white people who have submitted their DNA to find out what percentage of Italian they are, for making this possible for us. But I doubt he had that on his mind. So he was thinking, my DNA is not anywhere. Nobody's even finding my victim. So who cares?
Yeah, I love that he was arrested from Midtown out on his usual snack, which was like a truck, you know, like one of those pushcart vendors, like a pizza.
Yep, we got him with the pizza crust
pizza
he didn't
crust.
Eat. Oh, and that's how we got his DNA. They already had unidentified DNA. And so they were able to, once they had used forensic genetic genealogy, they were able to narrow down through the family line. And so they were just confirming. So they had to get some kind of evidence somewhere. So they found the pizza crust he discarded, and they happily took that and were able to get that match. So some of the wife's hair, she has long blonde hair.
She's from Iceland.
Was found on
three
of the victims perhaps. And then so some people are saying that because of that, she's involved. But we don't have any other evidence, and law enforcement has not found any evidence or they would have quickly arrested her.
She was out of town during those murders.
She was out of town during those murders. But they did perhaps, there's some talk that perhaps they did some deviant sex stuff. Like they would have swinger parties, and that maybe she knew that he solicited sex workers, and that maybe to some extent she was involved in the dumping of the bodies with the hair or whatever. But I think what's more likely is that she knew she was married to a not great person, but nobody thinks that their not great person is a serial killer. Like, I don't think that home was nice and fun and happy, right? It doesn't seem to be that he was that good of a pretender. I don't think any of our serial killers ever pretended that well at home, right? Their homes were still pretty troublesome, right? They didn't have these great normal lives usually. And so I would bet that home was probably pretty unhappy, that maybe they were into some kinky stuff, and that she sort of let him do his own thing after a while, you know, and kind of they lived kind of separate lives is what I imagine. Now, do I think she should be getting multi-million dollar deals? No, I think that looks really, 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 really poorly upon you and everyone involved in that. And I just know that she's getting a lot of hate in the media. It was almost immediate. This callous part of me does not think it's just because of the hair that was found. I think that typically our society loves to blame women, and that even in this instance where we have this horrible man doing horrible things, we still want to find a way to blame his wife.
Right, because she's a mother and therefore she's responsible for everything.
Or just that bad woman story that we tell over and over and over and over again in the news. Like, oh, maybe she was frigid and she wanted these women dead. Just whatever narratives we sort of push. Like, why can't we just focus on Rex? Why do we have to talk about his wife at all? Like, let's focus on the serial killer. How about that?
Right, and because their whole family is a victim now to this.
Yes, until you take a million-dollar deal from Peacock.
Well, let's give the benefit of the doubt. Maybe there's still time. Maybe some of the money I would hope that money would go to the victims and their families, because I know that she's battling breast cancer. So trying to give the benefit of the doubt, but we'll see. We're being optimistic
today.
But
in what way does that look good, though?
It doesn't.
Like, even if you give, even if you're like, I'm secretly taking this million-dollar deal from Peacock.
After she got the money from the sale of their house,
yeah,
I believe,
yeah,
as well.
Half a million-dollar
house.
How do you give it to the victims then? What do you do? Do you show up at their doorstep with a bouquet of flowers? Like, you know, it's lame. No matter which way you take it, it's real lame. And to an extent, I mean, really, I guess, again, I'm blaming the woman here. Why is Peacock offering anybody $1 million? Why didn't Peacock offer? Why can't Peacock mind their business until this case is solved? Because we know when the media gets involved, it usually messes things up. A, how about that? Let's put the justice system first and the semblance of justice that we have for the victims first. That would be the right thing to do, A. B would be to offer the money to the victims, right? What? Why isn't there a story in that? that? What about their process through the trial? Have we ever seen that live action? Maybe society could benefit from viewing that process more than some serial killer's wife's process, right? Like, I don't know if I've heard the victim's family's experiences through the trial. Like, if you're trying to tell a story, there's a story there. I mean, maybe they offered them that and they didn't take it because they didn't want that. So it's just not right.
No, I agree.
I'm trying to find a way to justify it, but I don't think there is one.
Yeah.
And then that becomes a larger discussion. Like, should families of serial killers be able to profit? I don't know.
Especially when they make these films about them in their very, you know, their family members, and books, films.
Isn't the Rex's wife still married to him? She filed for divorce. But can't you takesy-backsy that? Right? Like, at any point, can't I pull my filing?
Yeah, why does it say, you know, filed for divorce? Why doesn't it just say divorced at this point? Because she filed, I think, a week after he was arrested in the summer.
I mean,
how long does it take to go
through? Sometimes it takes a year. Sometimes you have to wait a year. Or there are rules, different rules in every state.
Where does the money go then?
Like,
where,
That's my question.
Their joint account.
Does he have any right to her money? If she gets, since she's accepted this deal, say, let's say the money has already been transferred, does he have any right to that money? Because that would violate the Son of Sam law, which says that no offender can profit from their crimes. And then, okay, we need to ask a lawyer, but let's say the law stands that no, he doesn't have any right to her money because she filed for divorce. What if she backsees it? What if tomorrow she decides she doesn't want to divorce him? Where does that money go? Does then he have access to that money?
It's a great question.
I don't like it. I don't know. I don't think we've seen this before. This is kind
Not
of a
in
new
real
thing.
Time, yeah. And such a prolific, like, they're going to now go into his home in South Carolina, Las Vegas, and look at crimes there.
As they should, because he is likely responsible for far more victims than just those four. And look, you can only charge somebody once, right? So the police are trying to do it right. I mean, you can only convict somebody once. So the police are trying to do it right. They're trying to make sure they got the right guy. They're trying to get all their evidence. This is a multi-jurisdictional investigation with high media attention, which means they have to go very slow because it's very complicated. So the police, in my mind, are doing just what they should be doing right now. Now, if we want to have that discussion about when those women went missing, probably not. But now I think that slow is better, especially with the amount of media attention that we're getting. Imagine they need to ensure that they have an unbiased jury and all of that other kind of stuff.
I mean, how do you be unbiased when this has been in the news for months?
I think the rule is you can have heard of it as long as you can attest that it won't affect your perception.
Okay.
But that's hard to measure in yourself, you know?
Right.
But we have an offender that is, I think, rare in a lot of ways.
Can you have a jury of just sex workers?
Ooh. And I wonder how those victims' families are feeling, you know?
The re-trauma of it all over
again.
Yeah,
it's all coming back up. But then here's a face to the name. Here's a person that you can finally link. That has to be, in a way, positive because it's not this ghost, you know? Now it's a person.
Right. Well, I hope in the midst of this, we keep hearing more about the women. I like that some of the attempts that have been made thus far and learning about their hopes and their dreams and who they were beyond what they did for a living. Because, right, we're so much more than our job, where we went to school, where we grew up.
And we focus on sex work so specifically. Like, we don't do that with teachers. We don't spend so much time. How did they decide to find this path of teaching, right? Like, we don't do that to it.
Don't ask that about podiatry. Yeah. I have a lot of questions.
It's just such a weird way we handle this. And I'm hoping that the way that language is changing around sex work is a positive thing. You know, I ask my students in class about, like, is camgirling sex work?
Yeah, so we're exchanging books now. We read a really lovely memoir called Cam Girl, about a girl that entered the foray into cam girling. And unlike a lot of the women that we've talked about today, she came from a background that was more privileged and she really didn't have to go into sex work, but she did. And the novel, yeah, so it's...
And what is sex work, Or selling feet pics sex work? That's what I ask my students and they all laugh. But that's a real question, right?
Right.
Like if selling pictures of your feet for somebody to masturbate to is sex work, then what's the line? You know what I mean? Like, maybe, and are we going to start describing people when they go missing and they sold some feet pics as sex workers? Probably not, right? So it's just interesting, this terminology that we use, and it's so value-laden and it shapes how society treats you. But in today's age, it's fluid. It's changing, right?
Oh, yeah.
This definition of sex work is changing. And I hope that as we destigmatize some of the forms of sex work, maybe it'll destigmatize other forms forms of sex work, and we'll stop holding that as such a powerful predictor of who you are as a human. That's my hope. Maybe that's maybe that's a positive thing. You know, 10 years ago, people weren't joking about doing that, and now they are. And so I think that might be a sign of something positive.
Yeah, absolutely. It's becoming more mainstream with like OnlyFans and some, you know, you're in nursing school, you hear of those people that have an OnlyFans account, but hey, they're doing, you know, their nursing classes on the side. They're not
so
sex workers.
When that person goes missing, how are we going to define them? As a student or as a sex worker?
Very interesting. Well, I think that's enough talking about the Ogre Man.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, we should spend less time on Rex.
Signing off.